You're listening to Season 2, Episode 22 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes in New York City and online and have built an incredible writing community. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation within the writers community. I'm so excited to share today's episode with you, featuring New York Times bestselling author Morgan Matson. Morgan walks us through her writing process for her newest book, The Unexpected Everything. She received an MFA writing, so of course we dived into a super detailed discussion about her experiences in grad school and whether or not it's crucial to a writer's success. We also dive into juicy discussions about writer's retreats, character building for character-driven stories, pushing past writer's roadblocks, pen names, and writing prompts. If you're a writer, you'll especially love today's episode. Now let's jump right in. Morgan, how are you?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. I know that a lot of people are really excited with your new book.
And oh, yay!
Yeah, I really want to get into that and unpack your writing process
sure.
for it and your inspiration behind it. But before that, let's get started and ask how you fell in love with writing.
I was always a reader. You know, since I was little, I was a voracious reader. But I never thought it was something that I would do kind of until midway through college, actually. Halfway through college, I got a job working in the children's department of a bookstore and sort of fell in love with YA literature and all this literature that hadn't been around when I'd been a teenager. And so that sort of changed my path. And I started taking creative writing classes and then ended up going to grad school at the New School in New York City to get my degree in writing for children.
Amazing. Okay, I actually have a fan question.
Sure.
And she's super sweet. She loves your book. And she actually wanted to know, for New School, do you think it was necessary to go to school for your writing to be successful?
It's an interesting question. People ask me this a lot because I actually have 2 graduate degrees. I just like them. But here's the thing. I don't know if it was helpful in terms of the actual writing that ends up on the page. I think it was helpful for a number of different reasons. I think for me, it was helpful because that was sort of like saying to myself and sort of the world, like, I'm going to take this seriously. I'm not just saying I want to be a writer. I'm actually doing something about it. And maybe for me, just for my own personal whatever, I needed that to be like, I'm going to take 2 years. I'm going to focus on this. I'm not just going to dabble at it here and there, which is sort of what I'd been doing. I'd been kind of doing it a little bit here and there. And it kind of gave me the space to take it seriously and sort of the validation to take it seriously in a way. It was kind of like, oh, someone said I'm good enough to get into this graduate program. I do think it really helped improve my writing. And I think it's never a bad thing to show your writing to people and be in critique groups and work with amazing professors. I mean, you're only going to get better because of that. And the New School was great just because it wasn't just writing classes. We were taking literature courses and we were analyzing the books with the best writers. I mean, I was taking classes with David Levithan and Sarah Weeks. And, you know, David was bringing in all his friends who were in publishing and Sarah was bringing in editors. And it was a huge education. I also formed a community. You know, some of my best friends who are writers, like Siobhan Vivian and Jenny Han.
Oh my God, we just had Jenny Han just last week.
Yay, I heard hers. It was great. I met them at the New School and I met this community of writers and I met so many people who are still my friends.
Oh, so you guys all go way back.
We go way back. Yeah, we've been friends for like 10 years. Yeah. And I mean, I also then got an internship when I was there because you're in New York City and it's the center of publishing. I got an internship through David Levithan at Scholastic that turned into a job as an editor at Scholastic. And I worked on teen books for a number of years. So it was helpful in a lot of ways in terms of meeting people, finding a community, learning about publishing, being in the publishing industry. And I do think my writing got a lot better, but I don't think it's necessary to be published. I think there's so many different paths to publication. That was mine. It worked out really well for me, but there were some other people in that program who it didn't. You know what I mean? So I really just think it's one of those things that everyone finds their own door.
for me, I do like writing workshops. I haven't gone to school with an MFA for writing,
right.
But I love the structure and just kind of feeling like there's a curriculum in a way, even though it's not really curriculum, but just having assignments, I'm just held way more accountable than I would be by myself, you know?
That's why I really like, even before I went to graduate school, I did a year basically just taking extension writing classes at UCLA.
Oh my gosh, I did too.
Oh, did you?
Yes,
so it was just, I like the structure and I like, okay, turn in 5 pages this week. And I just think anytime that you're putting something in front of your peers and letting them read it and come back to you with what they think, that's good.
Yes.
You know, because that's what publishing is that you're going to get an editorial letter, you're going to get notes from your agent. I mean, it's nothing but getting notes from people. So the sooner you can do that, the better.
It's true. And psychologically, it feels even more real that I'm making it happen. So it
totally
encourages me even more, you know?
Absolutely. And you learn. I mean, one of the things I loved about grad school was I love giving other people notes. I guess that sounds weird because also I was an editor. Like, I love looking at books and seeing how I can fix them. You learn so much also through other people's writing.
Absolutely.
And that's the gift of writing workshops, I think.
Thank you so much for going into detail with that. What drew you to young adult fiction particularly?
Well, I mean, it was really when I was working in the bookstore when I was in college and I was in the children's department and reading all this YA and really sort of fell in love with young adult literature. And so then I only really was looking at grad programs that had a focus in young adult literature. And so then when I was in the new school, David Levithan was an editor, vice president, I think, actually, at Scholastic. And he was like, we have internships at Scholastic. And I was like, oh, I'd love to do that. So yeah, I never really went any other way. It was all sort of, that was my focus.
That's really cool. I know you've done school, but are there writing retreats outside of school where you love and you could recommend or just share an experience?
I love writing retreats. I just came back from one that I go to at least once a year. Sometimes we do it twice a year in Colorado.
Oh,
and
nice.
Then Jenny Han organizes amazing writing retreats. I love them. So that's sort of a yearly highlight. And then I'm going off to do another one like next week.
Oh, nice.
I know. So I really love a writing retreat. These are all just sort of friends organizing it themselves kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But I just find it really helpful just because I think it's kind of like the same thing I just said about grad school, actually. It's like that moment of like, okay, I'm going to leave my house. I'm going to leave my dog. I'm going to pay for my share of the house to do this thing. It really sort of holds you accountable. Like, I get a ton of work done during those weeks because I think you're really aware of it. It's a great way to catch up with people you maybe don't get to see all the time, you know, catch up with friends, do work in a really focused way, meet new people. I really love writing retreats.
It's like a productive vacation.
It's super great. I look forward to them all year and I get so much done. So I love a writing retreat.
Now, I know you mentioned your dog and talking about that, I want to talk about The Unexpected Everything.
Okay.
Let me tell you, when I was at the bookstore, I saw your cover and that's what caught me were
oh,
the dogs.
Good.
I am a huge dog lover, so I'm just like, oh my gosh, what is this? I need to check it out. And lo and behold, it was awesome and loved it.
Oh,
so
thank you.
I'd really love to jump in and talk about the inspiration behind The Unexpected Everything.
Sure.
What inspired you to write this book and also like the political background, politics and all that? My goodness, what was the inspiration behind all that?
It was almost exactly 2 years ago. It was May 2014. And I was on book tour and I was in Virginia. And I think it may have been just because I was so close to DC. I went for lunch and I was telling the story on book tour and some people remembered. Twitter went down for like 2 hours 2 years ago in May. And I was so kind of like, oh my gosh, like I was just going to bring my phone with me to have lunch. And then Twitter was down. And so I was like, oh, I'll just bring my notebook instead. And thank God it was, seriously, because I feel like if Twitter hadn't gone down for 2 hours, like I might not have written this book, which is crazy. And makes me feel like, okay, Morgan, leave your phone at home more often. This is ridiculous. So I like walked down the street to this restaurant. I had my notebook. And I think because I wasn't sort of on my phone mindlessly, you know, checking stuff, my mind wandered a little bit. And I do think it was because I was so close to DC. And I was just thinking about what it would be like to grow up in the shadow of that. Like what that would have been like. I'm sort of fascinated by politicians' children, just because it's this weird thing where you're a part of the package. I feel like you're always in the candidates' ads and you're next to them at the campaign stops, but you don't get a choice in this. But you're a liability also in a weird way. Like it's this very weird thing. I feel like the children of politicians, it's a very interesting thing we have going on. So I was thinking about that and I was thinking about what that would do to someone. Sort of, I think you'd learn from a very early age to always be aware of what you said and that any misstep could be sort of amplified, especially in this 24-hour news cycle thing we're living in, and sort of what that would do to your relationships and your friendships and how that would shape you. And then I started thinking about, okay, if this was this girl who always learned to never be vulnerable and always be aware of what she's saying.
What about the research process for that? Was that a long process?
My brother, one of his friends worked for the vice president. And so I was like, I need you to go get me his information, like get me his email, tell me that he's in the private sector now. But I was like, I need to talk to him. I want to talk to him. My brother was like, I haven't talked to this guy in years. I was like, do it. And so he reached out to this guy and got me his information. And then I never contacted him. And my brother was like, why did you make me do that? I think it was at that point, I'd sort of done enough research on my own.
Right.
And I kind of didn't want someone to tell me I was getting it all wrong. And it also, it was less important to the story than I thought it was going to be early on. Like, gotcha. Because it is sort of the scandal happens and then the dad's at home. And, gotcha. You know, and so I was sort of like, I'm happy with how this is. I feel like I've gotten stuff right. I have a lot of friends in Los Angeles whose parents are very well known. And so I feel like I knew enough of what it was like for them in that experience and to sort of, you know what I mean? So I feel like I could sense what it was like to have a public figure as a parent through them, you know, in the industry out here.
Gotcha.
So yeah, my brother is still really mad at me.
So funny.
Just because I was like, I liked knowing it was there. Like I had this guy's email sort of like break glass in case of emergency.
Yes.
That I could be like, wait a second, I actually don't know how to do this. But I was kind of like, I feel like I'm happy with the story I'm telling. It checks out with what I've been able to research. Sometimes getting too much research is actually worse.
Oh, okay, because you start thinking too much?
Or I just think everyone's experience is slightly different. And I think that if someone's like, no, it's B, it's like, well, but what if it's A for this person? You know what I mean? Like, I think sometimes you read something and it can become very almost like blinders on. So I sort of did the research I did. I had this guy's number if I needed it and then didn't end up using it.
So now with the best friends, mm-hmm. I love the text messages between them. And it feels so real, especially you throwing in emojis.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you liked it.
I loved it. I was super curious. Were there any legalities or legal issues in using the emojis? Because they looked like the exact emojis we have on our iPhones.
Oh, that's great to hear. They're not.
Oh, wow.
So the emojis were a big thing for me just because I'd never written a group of friends before. And so I really wanted to sort of capture. I have this ongoing group text with some friends that's just like that. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just like never ending kind of.
Yes.
And it's like, if you looked at my phone right now and you pulled up my texts, it's like 90% pictures. Like I use emojis so much and it just started to seem really false to me if I was going to be showing text messages between a group of people that they wouldn't be using emojis. That felt weird. It would be like if people were using weird text slang now, you know what I mean? That no one does anymore because the iPhone writes the whole word for you. Like no one needs to do the shortcuts anymore. It would have felt like weird and anachronistic, I thought, to not have emojis just because that's the way I text. And I think that's just like, it's a moment we're living in right now that's super fun. And I wanted to show that. So I told my editor, I was like, I really want to use emojis. And he was like, I don't know if we can do that. And I was like, okay. And at first I was like, oh, it's okay. Cause then, you know, it like grows into this kind of large subplot about the emojis. And I was kind of like, okay, I guess we could cut this out if we can't end up using them. But it was getting harder and harder to imagine the book without them. So I was just forging on ahead. Meanwhile, Simon & Schuster's having all these meetings with legal, lots and lots of very high up people having meetings with legal to try and figure out how we can do this. And I'm like, guys, I'm so sorry. I just wanted like a unicorn in my book. Like, what have I done? And so it was a lot of stuff on their end. And finally, my cover designer designed her own emojis.
Oh.
Yeah. So they're very similar, but she did them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, and there might be some that she didn't have to. I don't know if it was that all of them were copyright. I don't know. I really didn't wade into this. I just know that she had to do a bunch of them herself.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Whew. Okay,
yeah.
So it was like a process.
It was a process. And meanwhile, I'm just like, guys, I'm so sorry.
Right?
All I had to do was figure out there's a program where you can put emojis in your Microsoft Word document.
Oh.
And so they were all in there when I was writing the book.
Interesting. Okay, gotcha, gotcha.
So that made that a lot easier. Like, I think I would have had trouble if I was just trying to describe which emojis I wanted. But, like, I have, like, the full emoji keyboard on my computer. So I was able to just put it into the Microsoft Word document. The fun thing is I haven't heard the audiobook yet. We did a lot of talk about the audiobook, about how we're going to do this. And I originally thought that I would sort of end up writing kind of a script for it, that it would say something, the audio narrator would read something like, Toby sent me a long string of emojis, including like clapping hands, unicorn, and pizza.
Mm.
And then they were like, no, we're just going to say all the emojis. It's going to be really funny. So I think it was my editor actually who was like, no, just have her say all the emojis. And so I haven't heard it yet, but people have told me that it's like, she'll be like, Toby, clapping hands, pizza, 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 rainbow, rainbow, rainbow,
that
unicorn,
is
unicorn,
so
unicorn,
funny.
Smiley face, smiley face, smiley face, frowny face, smiley face. She just reads them like straight out. And so we had a lot of back and forth as to what they should be called. There's like the emoji guide, but some of them are not what I would call them at all. Some of them are not doing what I thought they were doing at all. It was a big process with the audiobook. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm so excited to.
These emojis are becoming the whole character within.
They really are. And it was like to the point where if they'd come back with me and been like, legal says we can't do it, I would have been really sad to lose them from the book, just because I do feel like they became a character in the book. And I've been hearing from readers, because the one character Toby ends up texting solely in emojis through most of the book, I've been hearing from readers who are like, I was beginning to understand Toby's messages by the end of the book.
It's so true, because I was like reading that, I'm like, wow, what a brilliant way of adding even more truth to your story.
Oh, good.
It just
I'm so
grounded
glad you liked it.
Yeah, I did. It grounded it even more. And it's just so real, like what's happening right now in 2016, especially. How long was your writing process?
I got this idea in May 2014. And then I think I probably started playing around with it. I mean, I can pull it up on my computer if you want. I can tell you the date I started writing it.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Okay, hold on.
I love that this is happening right now. This is so cool.
So I definitely got the idea in May, just because I keep a schedule of all my books. And then I started writing it on October 21st, 2014. So I got the idea in May and really started writing it in October, and then turned in the first draft in March.
Oh, wow.
The end of March. So October, November, December, January, February, 6 months to write the first draft. I tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the book and the characters before I write it, because I basically start writing and then just write straight through to the end.
Wow.
Once I start writing, it's like I already know kind of the characters and what I hope is going to happen. And I don't have an outline, but I really spend a lot of time thinking about the characters and their backstories and who they are.
Okay, I would love to unpack that. And
sure.
If you can walk us through, because I think it's really fascinating when authors don't have outlining processes, mm-hmm. like an outlining habit. Mm-hmm. You have this idea pop up. So I'm assuming you're writing notes like immediately when something comes to you. So you're not searching for an idea. You kind of go through your day. You've written books before. Mm-hmm. Then let's say the unexpected everything didn't happen just yet. How do you just grow it and pack on more details from there to then start creating pages and pages upon pages?
I just sort of kind of talk it through in my head. You know, it's no one has a name at first. It's just kind of like, what if this girl and her dad's in politics? And I mean, I save all my notebooks, so I have it usually by hand, sometimes on my computer, thinking about a bunch of different things. It was sort of the idea of this girl and then a guy who would sort of compliment her. I also really had wanted to write a book about a friend group for a long time, and I hadn't done that yet. So then it was like, oh, okay, maybe she has this like solid group of friends. And she's not just like meeting a whole new social circle in the beginning of the summer, like has happened for the last few of my books. It's kind of like a snowball. It just sort of rolls down a hill and gets fatter and fatter. Sometimes I'll be like, oh, and what about this? And then a day later, I'll be like, no, I don't think it's that. I just kind of write out different possibilities and see what feels right.
When is it time when you start to develop your characters more?
I'm always thinking about who these people are, what their backstory is, what their history is, what their lives are like. That's always sort of where it starts for me. I just think about it for a few months and I just think about these people and their lives. And sometimes I'll be like, oh, maybe this thing happens. Then I'll be like, no, I don't think that happens. I haven't written like word one of the actual document yet. I'm just sort of walking around letting these people start to feel like real people.
Got it. And when you're writing these, when you're transferring your notes over, what software are you using?
Well, a lot of this is just me writing longhand in a notebook.
Oh, wow. Like fully notebook.
I'll usually have like a document on my computer where I'll just sort of stream of consciousness type when I get an idea. But then I'll also just be like writing down, like scribbling down thoughts in a notebook.
I like writing in a notebook, but then I get so scared I'm going to lose my idea. So I'm like, oh my God, I have to really just save it somehow or upload it.
You have to back it up. Yeah,
back that stuff up or else it's gone.
Oh my gosh, so funny.
And so I just also want to know, like, how did Andy, was she a mixture of you and a couple of friends? Or was she just like kind of took a life form of by herself?
Yeah, she's not really like me, which was interesting to write about because I feel like a lot of my heroines have been more like me. So it really did sort of start out thinking about a girl who would have grown up in this situation, sort of before she even understood what was happening, she understood that she had to be on in a way. You know what I mean? That she sort of always had to be aware of herself. I sort of built it out from there. I also wanted to, I feel like I fall into this trap, and I know so many writers do, is we tend to write about people who are readers and writers because that's what we are.
Yeah.
But I was like, that's not realistic. So I really want to try it about a girl who loved math, who loved science, who was very logical, and who didn't like to read. Because I feel like you rarely see that in books.
Yes, I agree.
It was fun to write about someone who was very different than myself. Very logical, very driven, but not a lot like me. Certainly not like me when I was in high school. So it was fun to write about someone who isn't like you in a lot of ways. I think it's freeing in a way. In a way, it can be easier. I really love writing my secondary characters. They're always sort of threatening to take over the book. And I think it's always easier to write a second, for me, it's always easier to write a secondary character than your heroine, because they're a little bigger. They're less carrying the weight of the story, and they can be there for fun. And so I feel like it's sort of the same thing when you're writing someone who is a little different than you. It can be a lot more fun.
Gotcha. I like that. What was the most difficult part about writing your book?
So I don't know how to say this without spoiling something.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay. So you'll know what I'm having. There's a scene at the very end between two people who aren't the main character.
Mm-hmm.
I did so many passes of that scene. That was the most challenging scene.
As in terms of making it as realistic as possible?
I don't know what it was about that. I just kept going back to it and I kept going back to it. And I was like, I don't think it's right. I don't think it's there. And I think part of it might have been that I didn't want what was happening to these characters to be happening. There may have been like resistance on my part to like send them down this road. But I think it was also a challenge that this wasn't the main character. Andy is a part of this, but it's not really her conflict. And so I think that was also hard to write about something that was very big and very seismic, but not directly happening to the protagonist.
How did you get yourself out of that difficulty?
This whole book is really me and my editor. He's such a huge part of my process. I dedicated the book to him.
I love the beginning, the acknowledgments. Yeah, I was like, wow, he must be so proud.
He's such a part of this process, and I love the way we work together, but it really is that I turn in the first draft, and then we get on the phone for 2 or 3 hours, and then he sends me a letter, and then we just work at it for months and do like 4 drafts until sort of every line has been kind of worked on. Wow. So it really does feel like we're in this together.
Is that common to have an editor be so close to the process?
No. So he's the fourth editor I've worked with, just because I also write books under a pen name. But I had a different editor for my first 2 novels at Simon & Schuster, and then she went to a different house, and then he took over. And our process was really different than he and I have. I mean, I think it is just every editor has their own thing. So the process with my editor who edited my books for Amy and Roger's Epic Detour and Second Chance Summer, it was much more like that. It was like I'd turn in notes, and then like a month later I'd get a long letter from her, and then I'd work on it for 6 weeks, and then I'd turn it back in. It's sort of, I think, whatever works for you guys, and this seems to work really well for me and my editor now. I'd just turning in drafts to him and being like, I don't think this scene is there, and he'd give me his thoughts on it, and then I'd work on it again.
How are you able to write so fast?
Oh, my schedule's more sort of when I've written every day and how many words I've written every day, just because I like to keep track of that. Every book has gotten slightly worse with deadlines. They're all running slightly later than they should be. It's not a good pattern to be in. My pen name is my middle name, so it doesn't really feel like a pen name, but I wrote 2 different trilogies under that name. I don't have anything coming up for Katie Finn, that's my pen name, in the future, but I'm sort of always going to wait and see if something bubbles up. Those books tend to be a lot more sort of plot-driven. They're both trilogies. Every chapter kind of ends with a cliffhanger kind of thing. They're a little bigger. I'd work on this, and then a few months later, I'd start the next Morgan Matson book. It never felt like it was doing too much at the same time, but I really like writing on deadline. I don't think I could write a book without someone waiting for it and needing it, so I like having open contracts. I really find that that's helpful for me to keep me on track.
When do you know to choose a pen name?
Kind of an interesting story. My first book ever was published under my middle name, and I was working at Scholastic. They were basically like, we want a book about the internet. And I was like, hey, I'll write a book. I just volunteered for it. And then my boss was like, do you want to write that book? And I was like, I really do. And I was already writing Amy and Roger's Epic Detour because I was in grad school at the time. So I knew it would be a really different book than this mystery about the internet that I was writing. It was more that I knew they would have really different feels to them. So it was kind of a way to sort of keep my debut being this book I'd been working on in graduate school and let this fun internet mystery be its own thing.
And then from there, you just kind of gradually like carried on and did more.
Yeah. I mean, the first book came out in 2008, so it's a long time ago now. Mm. And then the series did better than anyone thought it would. So then they were like, let's sign up 2 more. And then it's a few years break from Katie Finn. And then it was a few years ago, I got an idea. It was like a really sort of soapy, revenge-y kind of book. And I was like, this thing about like revenge and the Hamptons is not going to fit in with this. And so I was like, oh, it's a Katie Finn book. And so that's where the second trilogy, the Broken Hearts and Revenge series, started.
I know that you studied a little bit of acting, right?
Yeah.
Method acting, you know how it is. You really get into it and you are that character.
Uh-huh.
So with writing, is that kind of similar where, let's say you're in the Morgan Matson mode, writing your Morgan Matson books, you write with a certain voice that's very authentic to you versus your Katie Finn books. Does that have anything to do with that?
They're coming from such different places. I mean, I think the Katie Finn books are really plot driven and the Morgan Matson books are really character driven.
Okay, gotcha. So it's not so much as emotions.
Yeah.
Or... Interesting. That's so fascinating for me.
It's fun. I feel like it lets you play with a different gear.
How do you feel like you've evolved creatively as a writer?
I mean, I think you learn sort of so much about yourself and your process just by doing it. It's kind of one of those things where you learn by like sitting in the chair and writing your books and writing the book that doesn't work and having to put it in a drawer. It's such a process. And it keeps changing too, which is also what can be frustrating, is that you think you have it down and then one book just kind of turns you upside down. And you're like, wait, I thought I knew how to write a book. What's happening? It's been a really fascinating learning process for me, sort of how you work and how you work best and learning to sort of go with stuff. I've sort of learned to be a lot better when ideas bubble up, being like, oh, okay, what's that? What's that about? What's going on there? And letting myself sit with them and think about them. I think it's really interesting to look back at a writer's career and realize you get to see the same stories kind of being told over and over again, even though they're wearing different costumes.
Mm-hmm.
It's been fun to sort of go with that and be like, oh, okay, you can't really see it at the time. You can't see it when you're working at it. But a few years later, you could be like, oh, I see. Like this thread is connected to this thing. It's a very sort of almost mystical thing that we do. And I think you sort of can't see it until you're a few years out from it. It's like, oh, that's why I wrote that book at that moment. I didn't know why I was writing that book at that moment at the time, but now I understand it.
It's pretty cool. It's almost like a reverse psychic.
It is. It's totally true. There's this line from a song that I love, which I think is so true. It's, the past is only the future with the lights on.
Ooh, I like that. What song is that?
It's from a song called Baby Come On
by
Plus 44. Yeah. I think it's so true. It's like, that's all it is. It's just the same, but you can see what's happening.
So I'm assuming you've gone through writer's blocks.
I don't really have writer's block,
what?
Knock on wood. I know.
Making us all jealous here.
No. It's definitely, I have a thing, but I don't think it's writer's block. What sort of happens to me is it's almost like a seismograph letting you know that an earthquake might be coming. It's a feeling of like, oh, something's not right. And it's, I'll be writing and I'll just sort of feel like I'm getting kind of stuck or just something's off. And for me, that's always my brain's way of being like, you've made a mistake somewhere, go back and fix it. Something in me knows better than I do. Like, I took a wrong turn, I didn't make an honest choice. Something. Like, a day later, I'll be like, oh, right, that shouldn't have happened. I'll fix that, and then I'll be able to keep going. So it's not really writer's block, it's more writer's roadblock. It's more like, don't go down this path, go a different
path. Gotcha, avoiding that.
Okay, avoiding it. There's usually a solution. I've never had a thing where I'm trying to write something and I'm just stuck. It's like there's a crack in the foundation. Go back and fix that before you keep building the house.
I like your intuition. It's like really strong. It's like, hello, let's go back to
this
part.
It's just what I've sort of found over time is it's kind of like, I'm like, what's going on? I read a thing once where it said, when you are stuck, go back to the last honest thing you wrote.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, I just took that to heart and I found that it seems to help. If you go back to the last place, you're like, okay, this is right. This is working. And you're like, okay, wait, what happened next? Okay, maybe that's not the right thing.
That just sat with me really well.
Oh, good. I'm so happy. I don't remember. I wish I could remember who said it.
Sort of like on a polar opposite. Could you walk us through that moment that you were super proud when it came to your work?
There's a moment in the book with the scavenger hunt scene. It's a good 60-page scene. It's long and it just sort of sits there in the middle of the book. And I was in love with this scene. I couldn't wait to write it. I was so excited to write it. But there was another piece of me that was like, why are you stopping the action of your book to send everyone on a scavenger hunt for 60 pages? This book is already long. Like, what are you doing? I was really sort of having this debate with myself. And I knew I wanted a scavenger hunt in the book, but I was like, maybe I'll just sum it up. Maybe I'll just be like, and then we had a scavenger hunt and this happened and this happened. And then it came down to it and I was like, nope, I don't care if this book is 2 weeks late. I don't care if my editor tells me to cut it. I have to write this scene. I'm so in love with the idea of this scene. And so I wrote it. And when I turned the first draft into my editor, I was like, you're probably going to cut this, but I had to write it. And he was like, are you kidding me? That's the crux of the whole book. Like, that's like a turning point.
Wow.
He was like, we can't cut it. It's hugely important. And I was like, oh, I knew that. Totally.
That is amazing. Are you serious?
Yeah. So I like no longer trust myself. And that's why I sort of like in this most recent book, there have been scenes where I was like, I don't think this is going to be in. But I'm like, but the scavenger hunt stayed in, so I'm just going to write it and let someone else tell me. I think I knew that because there was a reason I felt like I had to write it. You know what I mean? So I think on some level, I knew that it was important. But that was fun because I just had such a fun time writing it. And then I love that it's in the book and sort of the way it evolved, the writing of it.
What about those moments that you did feel like you had to write and then your editor is like, hell no, this needs to be cut out now?
I'm really good at sort of letting stuff go. I tend to write very long first drafts and I just sort of tend to write everything. Like even in my first book with my different editor, with Eamon Roger, she was like, this whole 150-page section at the end where you introduce these new characters and they go to this family reunion and all this stuff happens and blah, blah, blah. She was like, just cut it, the whole thing.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like, but that was like a month of my life. But she was so right. She was so right. And so I think early on, like having that sort of like surgery just helped me to be kind of like, okay, it's not going in there. That's fine. Because I think it all informs character. Even if you don't get the story, I know the backstory.
Yeah.
And maybe there's like one line that is left over from a much longer scene. But this is like such a weird diversion. I'm going to like take us on a little tangent right now. I'm sorry. Have you seen You've Got Mail?
Yes.
So I'm obsessed with Nora Ephron. I love her movies. I love her writing. Oh, this is such like a deep cut. But there is a scene in You've Got Mail where everyone, Tom Hanks and Parker Posey, are stranded in an elevator with this older woman in the elevator guy. And they're just all sort of sitting around the elevator. They're being stuck and they're talking. And the older woman, who we've never met before, we never see again, says something like, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to call my mother. I wonder what she's doing right now. And then you leave and the scene goes on. And I remember when I was watching it, I was like, that's such an interesting, specific thing to give this woman that we never see again. Like, it was like she had this whole life that we didn't see. And that was sort of like a click moment for me where it's like everyone's super important. Your secondary characters, you need to be able to like swing the camera over to them and have it be their movie in a second, and you have to know everything about them. And then I got a copy of the You've Got Mail shooting script and I realized there was a reason that woman was there, because she was a character. She just got cut, but she had a whole backstory and a whole name and all this stuff in the original shooting script, so that like one line made a lot of sense. So it was more sort of like, even if you don't get the whole scene, you get that one line. And that's like, it all sort of makes it worth it in a way. So I love sort of writing more than we'll need, because I feel like you get it in little tiny moments.
What are some small manageable steps that you can advise the listeners who are working on their own stories that can help them attain their goal?
Unfortunately, a lot of writing a book is learning how you write a book best. Maybe you need to have an outline. Maybe that will really help you to have a structure and sort of know what's happening from chapter to chapter. Or maybe it's not. Maybe you need to just kind of go in and figure it out. But I would say turn off your internet. Use a program like Freedom or Citrus or something that will shut off the internet, just because a lot of writing is just sitting and fighting the urge to procrastinate and just learning to be focused. However, it's going to help you get your pages. I tend to go by word count. I tend to count the words I've written every day and I keep it on that schedule, and that helps me feel like I'm on track. I wrote my first book and then realized, oh, if you just write this much every day for a few months, at the end of it, you have a book. That felt like magic somehow. That like, oh, you add up all these days of working and then at the end you have enough and it's a book. It's not writing the whole thing all at once. It's just little everyday steps. I think have sort of a plan, like, okay, like this week I'll write this many words or this many pages or I'll write this scene. And I would say if you can, if it's feeling good and you can push through, it's so helpful to finish something.
Yes.
Because until I got my first book contract to write the internet book, I never finished anything. I'd had a lot of starts and I'd had a lot of kind of going towards the middle and then giving up. And whether or not it works out, whether or not it turns out well, just to know that you've finished something, gone over that hill and down the other side is huge. It's huge. And then I think you can look back at what you've done and be like, okay, what worked for this process for me? What didn't? What can I do better? Like, what can I do to fix this book or leave it behind and start a new one? Knowing that you've done it and you didn't give up and you've seen something through to the end, just psychologically, is hugely important.
What's your average daily word count?
Did you ever read the Stephen King book on writing?
Everyone is recommending it. No, I have not.
It's a little, I mean, I wonder if it's a little dated now. I read it when I was in college. His like one line about this has like shaped the way that I work, but he talks about how he tries to write 2,000 words a day and that's his baseline. So I think when I started writing, I was just like, oh, Stephen King says 2,000 words a day, I'll do that. So that's what I try and shoot for. But oh, wow. I think that's on the higher end. A lot of my friends who are writers are like, what? But I do tend to overwrite and I tend to write fast. So that feels like a good fit for me.
Okay, gotcha.
And then as I get closer to my deadline, the word counts are getting a lot higher.
Do you normally have a better time to write for yourself, whether it's in the day or at night?
It's interesting. That's also changed. I used to much more be a night writer, especially when I was getting down to like the last month of a thing. I used to do this thing where I would like sleep during the day, wake up at like 4, start writing at 7, and write until like 5 a.m.
Wow.
And now I'm like, what? That's crazy. Like, that's a young person's thing. It's interesting because I feel like with every book, your schedule changes a little bit. So now I sort of like to start writing in like the late morning, early afternoon, and kind of write through until dinner time and then take a break. And then sometimes write again after dinner.
Wow.
But sometimes not. I mean, I used to be able to write a lot more at night and I'm finding I just can't anymore.
So are you writing full time?
It's been my full time job since 2009.
Wow, that's badass. Good for you. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's a huge deal.
Thanks.
That's exciting. Oh my gosh.
It's exciting. And sometimes it's like, wait a second. There's no stability here.
No, it's so freaking awesome. I mean, that's the life of an artist. You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
like,
indeed.
You're doing what you love to do. And then when it comes down to like, we know what we have to do to just pay the bills, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. For better or for worse, it's life of an artist. But
do you have any writing prompts that you can recommend?
So there's a couple. I had a class in college where we had to do this. We had to write our manifesto. We basically had to write, this is important to me. This is who I am. This is what I believe. I remember doing that in college. And then I was in graduate school in New York City. And I think I was just sort of like, what am I going to write about next? And I remembered that. And so I think I wrote about the things that are important to me. And one of the things I wrote about was I love long cross-country road trips. And I think that sparked the idea for Amy and Roger, which is about a cross-country road trip. So I feel like that can be helpful to just sort of take an accounting of yourself and be like, okay, if I was going to write my manifesto and I was going to say, I'm Morgan, this is who I am, this is what I believe, this is what is important to me, these are the things that I love, you can distill what's important to you and what you might want to write about. I also think that you can kind of trick yourself into writing sometimes. Not so much anymore, but especially when I was starting out, I would do a bunch of free writing, sort of like journaling, but not. I would just open up a document on my computer and I would just be sort of writing about what was happening. I'm at the computer, I'm in the coffee shop, I'd sort of work out what I was going to write that day or just kind of work stuff out. So you're writing, but there's no stakes to it yet. And you can sometimes find your way into a scene like that if it seems like it's not real. You know what I mean? Like the blank page is less scary when there's a whole bunch of bad writing before it. Like it doesn't seem so intimidating. And also, I watched a video where the screenwriter, he does this thing called yelling at the page, which I think is interesting. Whereas if you get stuck, just say what you're feeling. Like in the middle of your scene, just be like, I hate this scene. I don't know what I'm writing. This is so stupid. But write it out. Like, this is so stupid. I don't know why I'm writing this book. I don't like this book. And just by the act of not letting that freeze you up, but not letting yourself stop writing because of it, you can sometimes get past it.
Oh, I like that. That's a really good one for getting past writer's block.
It was the man who wrote Life of Pi and Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, a screenwriter, David McGee, I want to say. And yeah, it was in a video series that the Academy does, which is all talking to different screenwriters about their process, which is fascinating. And another thing I do when I teach writing workshops is just write for 5 minutes and don't let your hand stop moving. And that can be super helpful for breaking stuff down, just because you know it's not going to be good. It's just 5 minutes. There's no expectations, but just get your brain kicked into gear and you write in a focused way for 5 minutes.
Yeah, just keep the juices flowing for sure.
Even if you're writing, I hate this, I'm terrible, this is the worst, why won't this end?
At least you're like, still writing.
You're writing something. Yeah.
Exactly.
And it usually like leads to weird, exciting stuff.
Thank you for that. Like, no, seriously, I'm going to apply that to my own because I know I get stuck a lot. So
it's so hard.
I feel like that's a brilliant idea.
And it's so easy to then, when it gets hard, just go online.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the more you can shut off the internet, I'm finding the better it is, honestly.
I know, it's so distracting with all this freaking Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, emails.
I think so much of writing is like being in a quiet place with your brain and trying to focus it. And like,
talk about retreats, right? That's why I love retreats. Like, everybody's there. You're
honestly
being held accountable. It's like a good peer pressure. That's what you want to create every day at home for yourself too.
Yeah, totally.
Love it. Okay, so this is the question I love to ask all guests at the end of the show. Can you recommend a book that has made a huge impact on you, whether in creativity or writing or life overall, that we can check out?
So there's a couple. There's a book about writing that I love called Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, I believe. It was written in the 70s, but it's all sort of about different feelings about writing. And she does the thing, and maybe this is my teacher got it from, where it's like, you just don't stop. You just write for 5 minutes. And It's a lot of her writing philosophies. She talks about composting, which is stuff needs to settle. Like sometimes you can't write about something for 5 or 10 years because it's all sort of breaking down in like a compost heap. She's Buddhist. A lot of like Buddhist philosophy in there that I love. That's a fantastic book that I love because it's about writing, but it's also sort of about life. I highly recommend that book. I love the writer Ann Patchett, the novelist, and she wrote a book of essays that I adore called This is the Secret of a Happy Marriage, which isn't necessarily about writing, but since she is a writer and a lot of them are personal essays, we sort of get her writing peeking out around the edges. And then I just read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic that I loved.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot about how many people love her book.
Yeah, it was really interesting because it's not necessarily about writing per se. It can be. It's more about creativity, but it's not about creativity for profit in a weird way. It's sort of about like just living a creative life and thinking about creativity and inspiration. And I just loved it. I thought it was great.
Morgan, you've been awesome.
This was
seriously
so great. I loved this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Morgan. Seriously, thank you for being so open and present and allowing us to unpack everything.
Oh, this was such a fun conversation. I loved it.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up our interview with Morgan Mattson. How awesome is she? Morgan, thank you again for being so much fun to talk shop with. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. Please say hi to Morgan over on Twitter at Morgan_M. For the awesome resources Morgan mentions in her episode, head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Morgan Mattson. I've been loving your messages and emails about the podcast and have been listening to what you're looking for. A lot of you have reached out asking about writing communities and classes, and I'm so excited to tell you more about Gotham Writers. If you're working on your own children's book, anything from a picture book to a young adult novel very similar to Morgan Mattson's The Unexpected Everything, I really want you to listen to why Gotham is an incredible asset to writers. They started in my favorite city of all time, New York City, my home where a lot of my dreams came true. Just like me, Gotham also believes that everyone has a story to tell, and they exist just so they can help writers like you tell your story better. You learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshopping, you learn how to enter the psyche of young people with a grown-up sense of craftsmanship. Gotham teaches writers all the elements of craft in a way that best resonates with young readers, and better yet, you'll learn how to entertain and enlighten young minds. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham will also introduce you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of heart and soul into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Gotham Writers to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.